This is Mary. She would be ash herself soon, like all the others. She thrust the letters one by one into the fire. The flames took their time, consuming the inked pages, turning indigo and vermilion and ochre, a dazzling radiance that penetrated the opaque wall of blindness that in the end had stolen from both of them their beloved avocation. How odd it was that in burning their lives, burning memory, color and light returned to her. I wanted to write this book because when I was in Paris in 2009 visiting with my husband and we were museum hopping, I learned an interesting fact, and that was that at the end of her life, Mary Cassatt burned all the letters that she had ever written to Edgar Degas and he to her. And that sparked enough interest in me to wonder what had happened between them. The other reason is that I have always loved Edgar Degas as an artist, and I used to dance ballet, and so he holds a special place in my heart.
You interweave this story of Mary and Degas with the relationship between Edouard Manet and Berthe Morisot. Would you elaborate on how the two couples compare?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I am not the first person who noticed that Degas and Cassatt had a mirror and a contrast in Manet and Morisot. Degas and Cassatt were different in that neither of them ever married, and they did not marry one another, and yet they had this passionate, lifelong relationship full of breakups and reconciliations and passion for their art. And Edouard Manet and Berthe Morisot were married. Berthe Morisot was married to Edouard Manet's brother Eugene, and Edouard Manet was married to a woman who may or may not have been his father's mistress. Their relationship, it was well known through the years that Berthe Morisot was in love with her brother-in-law. And so I thought that those two contrasting relationships in that small circle of Impressionists were an interesting counterpoint to one another.
Mary is stunned by the brilliance of Degas' work. You write from Mary's point of view, the others painted beauty, Degas painted life. He painted with his soul while she was still searching for her own. How does Edgar help Mary find her soul?
Edgar Degas never had a student in his life. He actually had one for 2 weeks and it was a disaster. So Mary was never actually his student, but he helped her in myriad ways. And one of the conclusions that people have come to over the years is that he helped her find her obsession. And Mary Cassatt was well known early on as being able to paint beautiful expressions on people's faces, which is what Degas most admired in her. And I believe that he helped her to find her subject, which was love, essentially, between mothers and their children. And in that expression, so oddly surprising for a woman who never had children, she was able to express a deep humanity, that of maternal love and child love, one for the other. And I think that without Degas' encouragement toward that end, she may have never been able to have gone on in her artwork. Indeed, he was the one who invited her into the Impressionist circle just as she was about ready to leave Paris and give up on art and go home. So he, I believe, was the link and the impetus for her.
He truly admired her work even early on.
He did. In fact, one of the widely reported things that Degas first said about Mary Cassatt was when he encountered one of her pieces of art in the Salon, the yearly exhibition of art that happened every year in Paris. And he encountered a portrait, I think it was of a woman named Ida, and what he said was, "C'est vrai," which means this is true. And he meant that she was able to capture on canvas the perfect expression of an emotion. And he looked out for her. He wanted to meet her.
We get some insight as to how Degas paints life with your description of how he perceives the city.
Outside, Montmartre shimmered in the setting sun. Above the encroaching city, the wind was turning the moulin. He could hear the windmill's blades slowly whispering as they traced their eternal paths. Beneath them murmured the tintinnabulation of kettlebells, the trill of a piano keyboard, the hollow click of a key turning in a lock, an escaped sigh of pleasure from a bedroom window. Degas stood transfixed, the chatter from the café, banal and urgent, falling away as he strained to hear the other. This aural innocence, the sonatas and a door slamming in amorous silences and the melody of Moulin dance halls offering seduction, seemed to Degas something essential. But he feared that no matter how many years he had left before his eyes failed him, he would never be able to capture on canvas the whole these simple sounds tore in his heart tonight. The landscape of yearning was always the next brushstroke away, a vanishing eternity no desire of his, no matter how ardent, could ever produce.
Sounds make their way into his yearning to capture this impression on canvas. In many ways, your novel is very instructive, and I couldn't help but think about aspects of Mary Cassatt's work and how it's been deconstructed, not by scholars or art experts, but, you know, there's this general perception that perhaps she sublimated her own longing to be a mother in her paintings. But the way you write the story, it's really one of much greater empathy that she has for her mother's loss of Mary's brother and her mother's worry about her other daughter's frail health.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that, because there is that popular perception that Mary Cassatt wanted to be a mother and was denied, which I disagree with, because early on in her life, she made the reckoning that to have a child would mean the end of a career, as it had for so many women. And so I had to look for another reason for her to be so enamored of maternal love. She was very close to her mother. She was very close to her sister. And when her sister died, it affected them all quite profoundly. And that is where I found my inspiration for Cassatt's paintings.
Hmm. The artists, musicians, and writers of 19th century Paris spent a lot of time together and sometimes crossed into each other's territory. You depict an argument between a poet and a writer, and then take another leap to describe the difference between writers and painters. With that part of the story, I wondered if you were asking yourself, so is a painting really worth 1,000 words?
It's interesting you should say that. You know, I believe that the creative process is the same for any medium. And so I used painting as a bit of a Trojan horse to talk about writing in this novel. The other thing that entered into that conversation was that that conversation between the poet Mallarmé and the novelist Zola, Emile Zola, I actually took that from public letters that they published in, I believe, Le Figaro in Paris back in the 19th century. They were having this public conversation about words, about poetry, about novels, about realism, about what was true and what wasn't true. So much of what they say in that particular argument comes directly out of that. It was not too great a leap to then think that if those writers were in the midst of all those artists, Degas would certainly take up the gauntlet to see if he could challenge Emile Zola to another verbal duel.
Well, it's also exciting to think about just being a fly on the wall in that time period, because there seemed to be an interrelationship among artists during that time that is warmer, is closer, is more informed than the independent ways that I think artists today work. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think so. And I think that was partly being in Paris, because the culture at that time was that they would get together in the evening, either at a cafe or at people's homes for the very celebrated salons. And they were highly cultivated, where poets and writers and artists all got together and intermingled. And so, you know, I look back with some nostalgia on that time, mm-hmm. because as a writer now, I keep trying to figure out how to make a salon in Seattle so that we can all get together and interact, because that's such a stimulating time for
Indeed.
All of them.
Well, you write about that quite vividly, too. We get sort of a social history of the city itself that you give. And you say that in Paris, art was the business of the city. How was that the case?
Art was indeed the business of the city, because artists and sculptors and architects came from all over the world, from every single continent, to study there in the City of Light. The École des Beaux-Arts was huge. There were studios everywhere. And the big salon exhibition that went on every year, usually on May 1st in the Palais de l'Industrie on the Champs-Élysées, that particular exhibition was mobbed from the moment it opened until the day it ended. Everybody went.
Yeah, you said laundresses. I mean, it cuts across social class and education.
Yes, it was, you know, I call them hod carriers, the people who carried coal through the city. They saved their money all year to be able to go see the art.
Well, would you talk about the relationship between Edgar and Mary? To say this was complicated doesn't begin to understate it. I mean, this is not a relationship one would ever want one's daughter or sister or any woman you cared about to enter into.
I would completely agree with you. The way I think about these two and their relationship, which began in 1877 and went on until the day that Edgar Degas died, with multiple breaks, as I said before, and multiple reconciliations, was that they were two impassioned geniuses who were interested in the same thing and who helped one another and who admired one another enormously. And that relationship was cut through by disappointments and decisions that the other person made and betrayals, and mostly set, I have to say, in turn by Edgar Degas, who could make decisions, you know, on the turn of a hat that would betray his friends. And he did betray Mary Cassatt several times on huge projects that they undertook together, and then at the last moment he just set aside, regardless of the consequences for Mary's career. And it was those kinds of betrayals that, I believe, broke Mary's heart. You know, he was a tempestuous, mercurial, very difficult man. She was a driven artist who wanted to succeed so badly and who admired this man. She called him her master, not in the sense of a servant and a master, but someone she admired so much she wanted to learn from him. So it was fraught through from beginning to end with love and anger.
In the end, you wrote, Mary has painted love and seen love and been admired for seeing and painting love. Somehow she has not managed to have love, and that it confounds her that her life must be devoid of love to have art. The title of the book is, I Always Loved You. Irony or unspoken?
Both, I could say. I will tell you that the working title for this book was I Never Loved You. You know, when you begin to write a book, sometimes you don't quite know what it's about, and at some point you have to decide what it is. And there spoke for me a moment in Degas' mind where Degas was basically denying his great affection for this woman whom he greatly admired. And so it was easier for me to write the book as I Never Loved You in order to stay within that tension between the two, always believing, however, that what he meant was I Always Loved You. And then when it came time to entitle the book, my editor, my agent, and I were going back and forth, and we decided to turn it into I Always Loved You.
And he did. And yet he was incapable of expressing it.
You know, one of the questions in the book is there room in life for two passions, for art and love? And that was part of the exploration for both of their characters. Were they going to be able to fulfill both? And I believe from Degas' point of view, he finally concluded that he could not.
Robin Olivera, I thank you very much.
I thank you so much for having me. This has been such a pleasure.